You're listening to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Gromatsky, and today I'm going to be talking to Deepak Rana, who is a management consultant with over 2 decades of experience. So thank you for being on today.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you. So having 2 decades of experience in management consulting, you would have come across a whole variety of different things. Can you share a little about just your career history and what you've seen and what you've done?
Absolutely, Alex. I started a career as a programmer, a software programmer, in a center for research in cognitive sciences. The idea there was to build smart and intelligent systems. One example, as you would know, is the programming that goes behind Roomba and all that good stuff. So back in the day, around two decades back, that wasn't really as popular as it is today. But we were trying to work in the research side of things to see if there is any benefit from a commercial software point of view. So we did that. After that, I transitioned to commercial software. I did a lot of projects in Japan, specifically in the financial sector and manufacturing sector. Clients included one of the biggest car makers before Tesla overtook them. And essentially, I moved to my US a few years after. I started in public sector, delivering services for people who really need help, building solutions that can actually provide them benefits as they need it, whether it's for child protection investigation, or child support, or even benefits, general benefits for any city and state government. And for the last decade, I've been working on large-scale business transformation, target operating model design, taking the clients through KPIs, making sure that they explain to us how they would like to see the future state, redesigning their organization, making sure that the end product, which is they get in within their organization, aligns with their own vision and strategy of the company. And then the tools and the technologies that are there essentially provide them that ability to perform at a pace that these days companies are expected to operate at. So that's what I've been doing mostly.
That's really interesting. And I know when the Roombas first came out, those vacuum robots, I think that was like the hit of the time. And so machines starting to take over the world, so to speak. So that's really neat that you had a chance to work on that type of project early on. And you mentioned that you worked in Japan and now in the US. How did you end up in Japan, and where were you before Japan? If you can just share a little bit about background.
Sure. So my initial career was in India. I'm originally from India. I spent my first 25 years there. There was a project that we were doing for a Japanese client. And they said, it'll be much better if we had you on site, because there were a lot of things that I wanted to accomplish. And just through this model of 8-hour difference, time difference did not make sense. So that's how I landed up in Japan. It was exciting. I learned a lot. Actually, I owe a lot in my career from that point onwards to Japan, because I learned a lot of things like attention to detail, things like how to actually make sure that you follow through on the requirements, being very sensitive to the culture. I went from an Indian culture to a Japanese culture, so we had to learn all that good stuff. And then I had to train a lot of team members also to make sure that they were following and were being culturally sensitive. So it was one of those very important phases of my career, and I'm glad it happened at the earlier stages of my career, because that shaped everything I did from that point onwards.
So I'm a little bit familiar with obviously US culture and Canadian culture, and then one of my senior executives when I was starting out my career, he was Japanese, so I'm very familiar with the attention to detail component and the respect. But I'm less familiar with the Indian culture. How would you say Indian culture is different from the Japanese culture to maybe the American culture?
So broadly, I would say it's very similar than different. I think the Asian cultures are more or less similar. But I think in Japan, there are certain things that you have to be very, very considerate about. And I think we used to do that back in India. Things have changed a little bit rapidly over the years. But similar to that, respecting your elders, making sure you bow, In India, we don't do the bowing part, but we have a namaste, right? So similar things, but it was far more formal in both the cultures, so it was easier for me to adapt. Very simple things, like we hand over, you know, business cards to each other. In Japan, you have to make sure that you do it with both hands. And if someone is giving you their business cards, you have to accept it with both hands, because it's basically respectful. And they, it's not that they expect, it's just something that they do it. They respect you, and they hope that you respect them back. And I think that's where the whole concept. Now, specifically talking about India, India is also the same thing, more or less. We are very respectful of our elders. We are respectful generally of anyone who is elder to us. Even my bigger brother, if I have 1 year older than me, I'll be a little bit more respectful to him than I would basically. Not that I won't have fights with him, but that's a different story. But, you know, there's a thin line, if you know what I mean. Some things that we don't cross.
And do you have multiple siblings? And
no, I just have cousins. I'm the only child.
Okay, I thought you mentioned you had an older brother.
No, my elder cousin brother.
Oh, so Alex's brother.
Elder okay. cousin brother. So I was just giving an example. So although we will have our own little tiffs, but at this, there are lines we don't cross with each other. That's the same thing. I found that in Japan also, there are certain things that, it's like respect, equity, and equality, right?
So going from India to then Japan to now the United States, is that something that was in your career plan or you could have foreseen happening?
No. I always wanted to be an army officer. My both parents were in the armed forces, but I think destiny had a different plan. So I just went with it. So wherever my career took me, I just had an open mind. I was like, I'll go anywhere where I can provide service and value to my clients. And it took me to different countries.
So you initially, I guess, when you were growing up, thought you were going to be in the army of India. Is that right?
Yes.
So it's quite a different career trajectory than what you had initially had thought.
Yes. Actually, earlier on, I very quickly learned how to adapt to change. And I think that's why I've been successful in different geographies, and I've been also very successful with different clients, because I can very easily and seamlessly transition from one particular culture, one particular set of clients to another client. And that is because, like I said, my initial ambition and my life's goal was to serve in the armed forces. Then I thought, you know what? Well, that's not happening because of an incident that happened. I had an accident of sorts, which made me medically ineligible to try for that. So I had to quickly pivot. And then I thought, let me become a doctor. And then again, I did get, I did get through the entrance exam, so to speak, in India. But at the end of the day, I chose not to do that for various other reasons. So as you can see from my career, I had early on, from my ninth grade onwards, I was very quick to realize that life is full of changes. The sooner you adapt to it, and the sooner you enable yourself to convert it into an opportunity, the better it's going to be for you. And because I could actually technically sulk at my home and say, I never went to the armed forces. I don't want to do anything. But that's not what happened.
But I'm assuming then that you moved around as a child quite a lot into different.
Yes.
So you were essentially, I'm going to say, forced to learn to be adaptable just by the nature of being moved around. So how often do you think you moved around as a child?
So mostly it would be around summer vacation. My parents were posted in different parts of India. So what would happen is my school wouldn't change from first grade to 12th grade. But the summer vacation, which is 3 months long, I would be in different parts of India, specifically where my parents are posted, either my mother or my father. Right. So I made a lot of friends, and I actually owe it to them. I actually owe it to many people that I came across, because they were welcoming. And they also transformed me into what I am today as a person.
Yeah, and I've come across the term AQ, adaptability quotient, right? We've heard IQ, and then we've heard EQ for emotional quotient. And now adaptability quotient is something that I've been hearing about more, especially, you know, as we come into the tech world and think about things like AI. It's not about, you know, what information is out there, because in theory, all the information is out there. But it's about, you know, what questions you have and what do you do with the information, and as things continue to change, how do you adapt to those new environments and I guess look for new solutions in new environments? So does that kind of fit into what you have to do with your clients and some of the management consulting experience and expertise you have revolve around being able to, I guess, observe various different environments and then try and look for solutions? Or if you can share a little bit more about what your day-to-day or practical work looks like, that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. So I think this is said by one of the Wharton professors when I did Leading Change with them. They said, humans don't change, they adapt. And we've been doing it for a very long time. And I do agree with him. So how I utilize is that, like, every company, every human, every person that you interact with, whether a part of an organization or at a friend circle, comes from a background and an environment they grew up in. And they have something, a culture that's behind that, right? A culture or unsaid rituals that are behind them, right? As far as if you're sensitive and you can actually understand what is the cultural important activities that you should or should not do, and you're sensitive to how people react, how you respond to their questions, you will adapt very seamlessly. You'll adapt very quickly and seamlessly. What I mean by that is, to give you an example, when I first showed up in Japan, that's the first time I realized that I was practically illiterate. I've never seen a kanji at all in my life. And a Japanese Narita airport has kanji all around, right? So generally you're used to seeing English signs that tell you go left, go right, or maybe, you know, this is the street name and all. And all of a sudden I was looking at kanjis. Now I had a similar experience when I was a child when I went to South India, but that was not so much impactful as I was in Japan, because this time I was on my own, right? Nobody to guide me. But what I had learned very quickly was that my organization and the Japanese organization we were working for had actually created a paperwork of sorts on onboarding and how to tackle when you land up in Japan, right? Now, what I'm trying to explain to you essentially about that is, from a cultural point of view, they had pre-trained us, but the reality dawned on me when I landed in the airport, right? So when somebody says, you know what, go and make sure that when you see somebody and you speak to them, make sure you bow to them, make sure you speak slowly and respectfully. Well, that's good as an onboarding thing. But when you land up in an airport and then you're trying to execute the same thing when you've never done it, you have to remember all that, right? And make sure that you don't make mistakes. Now, that's adaptability. Now, there are people who've made more mistakes than less, and there are some people. But the point is that I think adaptability goes both ways. In my case, I've been lucky that the clients I've worked with, the companies I've worked for, they've been equally kind to me, and I've been very sensitive to their needs. So they've been open in telling me, I expect you to do it this way, and I listen to them, and I make sure I do it that way, so they understand that I got the message. And similarly, they respect what I expect from them. So like I said, it's a two-way street in terms of adaptability. And in Japan, I learned it, like I said, it was a foundational battleground for me to shape my career, because I learned a lot there in terms of how do you transition. Although the transition wasn't so dramatic for me, because I was more or less going from the same culture in India to Japan, but there were certain elements that I had to be very careful on day one, right? And when you're put in that position and you go through that experience a number of times, I think your intelligence, or you're basically learning, if you're a lifelong learner, you start noticing things, and then it becomes second nature to you, right? So now, believe it or not, if I'm working for a European client, when I'm working for a Canadian client, when I'm working for an American client or a Japanese client, I would switch on and off based on how I'm having a conversation. And that's just because I've been exposed to this. So it's like, I still may not be exposed to many cultures, so I'm sure I'm gonna make mistakes when I show up in certain part of the world, but I think I'll do okay. So if talking about adaptability, I think that would be a lifelong learning effort from your side that you will have to put in to make sure that you are sensitive to other people and make sure that they realize that you're sensitive to them by acknowledging and listening to them. of the subs. Long-winded answer saying how to get to adaptability.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to you. Essentially, we're given some tools by your employer to say, hey, here's some things to maybe be ready for. And my experience is also, you know, there's a lot of information that we might have, but we necessarily don't know what to do with it. We don't know how to anchor it or how useful it's going to be. And also, if you take in all the information that exists, I think it's just information overload for your brain. So I think your brain kind of picks and chooses what it thinks might be important based on the experience that it has. But then when you actually get into the situation, you're like, oh man, like I heard this, but I don't maybe remember it, or I didn't think that this was actually going to happen. And maybe a little bit of a reality check comes in. So then you have to learn to adapt with kind of the tools you have, the information you remember, and go from there. And given that you have past experiences, it's probably easier for you to adapt in those environments and therefore then also adapt and listen to different clients that come from different backgrounds, have different problems. So it's an important skill that you've had to develop over the years. So I'm thankful that you've shared that with me. So are you able to talk about any of the projects that you're working on these days that excite you on the management consulting side?
Yeah, there are many, but I won't be able to give you the client names and all. But at a high level, I think in the past, a few things that I've done is specifically enabling technology to help people who are looking for benefits. So that was one of the public sector engagements that I'd done in the past, and that included not only providing financial benefits like child support to kids who really need it, not only child protection, but let's say food stamps and all that. So that's one very fulfilling project or number of fulfilling projects I did. From a commercial side, recently helped a very big client merge as two entities. And also there was a divestiture that happened both in life sciences company. The important part of the divestiture was that you were trying to separate an organization from a very large organization. Whenever a divestiture happens, what really happens is the culture stays, but the tools and the methods that are there sometimes have to be scaled down. So certain things that you're used to go away. Right? So you have to actually make sure that the people who are now divestitized, moving away from that bigger organization, don't feel that they made a mistake to hang around with this. So that means that the beauty of that culture, the tools that they need are still available to them at a reasonable cost. So those were the things that we were able to accomplish, was to take a very large organization, help them move out a small organization from within their own organization, but still maintain what was good in that organization, maintain that tools, methodologies and methods, so that because they were still serving the same industry, you don't want to make mistakes in that same industry, right? Otherwise, you can lose your customer base. So that was very exciting. Similarly, the merger of two companies is always exciting, although many people have told me, and I agree, there's technically never a merger. It's always an acquisition, but that's debatable. But again, combining those two cultures into one, along with technology, right? So sometimes technology helps you with overcoming certain challenges, but vice versa is not true. You can't use technology to solve a culture. You can basically, if you solve for culture, you solve for the structure, you solve for the political aspects of an organization, then technology can seamlessly help you accelerate your processes, because for some people, it's going to be completely different. How do you make it easy for them has been very fulfilling for me, because I have, over the years, because I've served in different industries, 9+ industries, and I have served 20+ clients, over my 2 decades of experience, it has given me an ability to identify what is important to the businesses. How do they want to measure their success? Like if you look at the front end, they want to measure their success from a customer lifecycle value. If you look at back office, they might be looking at back office efficiency. Right. So I still haven't talked about technology, though technology is an integral part. But if you know how they want to measure their business and how it ties to the strategy and the vision, then everything trickles down completely, seamlessly. And then you can put the right technology at the right place to fill the holes that they might have, that they might need to solve for whatever problem they're facing. So from my point of view, it's been a very fulfilling career, and it continues to be fulfilling because, as you might have already seen from what I just said, right, public sector, M&A, automobile industry, waste management, and these all things kind of have one thing in similar, that every business needs to know how to realize their vision, and then how to measure how they're actually operating with respect to their mission statement that they have, right? So as far as we can ensure that whatever vision they have for their organization and the mission they have aligns with whatever investments they're making in, is very fulfilling. Because at the end of the day, if the company leaves by saying, hey, that was an investment, one is ROI, which is a financial ROI, but then you look at the organization and say, oh, people also adopted it and they are successful in their day jobs and they can do more with their day than they were able to do it previously, that's very fulfilling. I mean, just hearing that in itself is very fulfilling when your customers tell you, oh, I transitioned from point A to point Y, I was very anxious. Now that you've made it happen, I'm not only seeing the financial value, but I think you've retained the culture, you've retained the good about our organization, you've slowly eliminated what was probably an impairment to our organization. And that is, that in itself is, you know.
Well, and you're doing it on the business side, where, you know, it sounds like you're going from vision to mission to like what company's trying to accomplish, and then paving a path for them as to how to get there, with, you know, either best practices and tools and set technologies. But if you can do that for a business, right, like if I can give an analogy to the to personal life, right, really that's what everyone wants. Everyone has a vision for their life. You know, they want to get to a certain place. They don't have a management consultant such as yourself that, you know, can maybe in their personal life help them and get them there with saying, hey, here's the best practices, this is what you should be doing, here's some of the technologies that will help you. And you know, some of us read books about that, but it might be some of us have coaches, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to get to where we want to get in our personal life. But on a business perspective, I guess the resources are there, your services are able to be provided for companies to reach their vision as to where they want to take their company. So that'd be really amazing if people could do that on the personal front as well. So that's a really interesting insight as to what you do. So are there any best practices that you guys have or that you have for, you know, when it comes to M&A or transformations?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'll share one of the things that that's a best practice where I would say almost everybody who touched my career is a contributor. So I can't say this is my best practice, but this is a best practice that has worked really well for many people. Going back to how you focus on the vision of an organization and the purpose and the mission, and then tie the return to that particular one. So in finance, you say, you know, you want a return on investment on a particular project, right? Because you're going to invest some money. But if you can really understand what's driving force behind it, is it really, and then you can understand the stakeholders that are either enabling or preventing that particular investment from succeeding. And then if you can get the buy-in from all the parties, that essentially makes a company more successful. Technology is easy. I can tell you, I mean, I've put in so much technology in my life that's the easy part. Making sure that people are comfortable, because certain times when you think about change, like I said, humans don't change, they adapt as far as you give them the right platform to adapt, right? Now, there are some extreme pictures of when humans have to adapt in, let's say, an Eskimo adapts in a very cold environment, right? I won't be able to adapt, right? Someone living in Africa adapts to really hot weather, right? But both are humans, right? They're adapting. Now, I'm somewhere in the middle, so I may not survive in both the places. But the point is, as humans, we survive. Similarly, companies also can adapt very easily as far as they have the tools and the, you know, the understanding of their environment. Now, you asked about personal life. I think this can be applied to a personal life also. As far as you understand the environment in which you are operating, you can use the same best practices. If you can have a clear vision of what you really want from life. I mean, people tell me, I want to have a ton of money. I want to become something like that. I'm like, no. Think about what do you really want? What defines you? What makes you happy? You know, spend a weekend just thinking about that and what makes you happy. The same thing, I think I even ask my clients to do that. Just think about why you're doing this. Not necessarily that you have X amount of dollars, you want to make the company profitable, so you want to invest in because you are getting a 12% return or something like that on your, or you're some kind of an ROI that you're getting now. Try to understand the rationale why you're doing what you're doing. If you can follow that, I can tell you whether it's personal or company, people don't fail. Because once you have the why, and I think I heard it somewhere, this was very beautiful. When you're building a ship, and the guys who are building the ship, if you tell them that you're not building a ship, but you're building a vessel that'll take you to high seas and you can explore different continents, then the perspective changes, right? You're not anymore building a ship. You're building a vision that'll enable a boat to take you places. So if you think, if you transition yourself and or a company to start thinking in that manner, success is inevitable, because then people really want to know where they're going. And once they know where they're going, the fear goes away. Once the fear goes away, you get the buy-in. And then it's just a matter of making things happen.
It's really refreshing to hear that kind of perspective. Do you think you come across a lot of people and companies that think that way? And if I can now ask and put it on you, you know, what's your vision for your personal life or for your career life or for your family, if you've given that some thought?
Absolutely. Actually, the funny thing is, it took me a long time to get that, but I just realized that I enjoy helping my clients at a professional level achieve what can be the best they can achieve in the given circumstances and the environment they're in. For my own personal life, as far as I can make people successful, whether it's my son, whether it's my wife, whether it's my client or my friends, whatever that might be, if I can help them in any way. Now, persuasion is a different thing, right? So I struggle with persuasion, but I think I've been gifted, and I don't know if that gift will continue for a long time, but I hope it does. But I have a gift that I can connect the dots very easily. So there are times when I can tell people, you know what, if you do X, Y, and Z, like in a game of chess, this is a potential outcome you'll have. This can be both negative or positive, and both have benefits and pros and cons. And then when the people make a decision, it actually works really well. So for me, if I can continue doing that, which is making very complicated subjects into a simple format that can be consumed by my son, by my wife, or by a client, and take the jargon and the cliches out, I think that'll make me feel really, really happy. And that we have a concept in our culture from Bhagavad Gita. It's not a religious book, but it's called karma. So if my karma, I believe, is to make sure that I am making a difference in somebody's life. And if I can make one person smile a day, I think that'll be great. Although some days I fail. You can't make everybody smile. You can't have that goal that is achievable almost every day, but I try, so if I can achieve that little goal, that micro goal, it's great. Some days I don't, but then I don't fret on it. I keep trying. That would be my way of thinking. So now I've just combined everything on what I really want to do and what I think my purpose is. Alex, I can't hear you.
Oh yeah, sorry, I had you on mute there. When me and my wife go on vacations, we have a goal of trying to get our kids to say, this is the best day of my life. So that's something that when we do reach that, whether it's, doing something exciting for them, it's very much rewarding. And then personal impact, I know what you mean by, if you can make an impact on one other person, that's big. And so me and my wife had decided, when our kids are slightly older, our daughter's 3 right now, that we're probably going to adopt, a 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 year old or some kid in that age, because that person will affect and have an impact on other people. And then also on my personal journey, I talk to other men that have issues and have broken relationships and broken homes, and if I can help them treat their wives better and kind of bring their families back together, that makes an impact not just on their life, on their wife, on their kids, and then everyone that they have an interaction with. So, we talk about generational issues that get passed down, but if you can, teach men to kind of start respecting the women and seeing them in a positive light and treating them light, then, they can, the kids will watch that, and that can create generational change down the future. So I hear you on that front. Me and my wife talk about purpose and vision a lot. So it's very refreshing, like I said, to hear your kind of take on that as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it. In fact, respect is very important, at least in my mind. I think you need to respect to gain respect, but at the same time, an equality. And again, equality, equity, and reality are 3 different things, but I think these are very, very important things. We are in a very dynamic place, and I'm sure we will recover from whatever mess we're in, because there's a lot going on. But I have faith. I have faith that we'll be successful as humans to take the next step. So,
well, humans are, like you said, adaptable. So if not, we'll just adapt to something else.
Absolutely.
And hopefully, it's not adapting to a lesser than life. And hopefully, it's adapting and changing the world to become a better than place, because that's sometimes, I guess, the fear in the back of my mind is that we're so adaptable that we don't even know that, as much as we're, believing that, and this is a philosophical thought in general, as long as we're believing that, our standard of living has gone up, and in many ways it has been, but to what degree, do we work more? To what degree can we actually live a better quality life and not have those mental stresses, those physical stresses, those the anxiety, the depressions and things like that people struggle with. So it's very interesting thought on that side of things. But is there anything else that you wanted to touch on and share with our listeners?
I think in my mind, I would say this is what I've learned. If every day you can do what you think you're supposed to do really well, and that's what I do for myself, that even if I'm doing a small task, I try to do it really well. And that makes me feel satisfied. And I think if people want to try that, they should try it. Because accomplishment gives you a dopamine hit that's much better than anything else, even though it's a small accomplishment. So that's my personal way of working. I get my dopamine hits by accomplishing small things. It doesn't have to be, I have to finish this 10-year large project. No, it can be a very small thing that today I just cleaned one of those utensils that was not getting cleaned properly, and I spent like 15 minutes and I just made it happen. So if I can perfect or do one thing really, really well that I'm proud of every day, that's enough for me.
Yeah, incremental improvements and trying to achieve excellence in some level that you can feel good about yourself and how you're showing up in this world.
Yes, and professionally also, one thing if you can improve every day, just one small thing, it doesn't have to be big. I think that you get a dopamine here, at least I get. So I'm assuming we as humans will all get the same. So that would be my thought in terms of how I operate.
Yeah, and whether that's a conscious dopamine hit or a subconscious dopamine hit, when you do something positive, you should, as a human being, have some positive feedback loop internally, so to reward you to continue down that path. So that's great that you do that on your personal life. It's great that you do it on your business aspect, and I appreciate you being on today and having this chat with me.
Thank you, Alex, for organizing this. I really appreciate it. This is a good thing. And I'm feeling good about myself already, because this just jogs in a lot of good memories that I had in the past. So thank you again, Alex. I really, really appreciate it.
Of course. Take care.
Take care. Have a good day.